Thank you, Karen. My name is Julia, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay. Let me just control my space here. Okay. My job up here is to give you an idea of what it was like, what happened, and how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, which is pretty well the best thing I've ever done in my life. It's the best decision I've ever made. And I didn't come in here willingly. Came in here a little bit kicking and screaming, and that's just the type of fighter I am. That's what I did in bars too, scary enough. So I grew up in Montreal in a French-Canadian home in Montreal West, and I'm the youngest of three. And for some reason, I didn't feel at ease with this family. That today I understand they are my biological family, but I really didn't feel like I belonged in that home. And I didn't feel the home was big enough. It wasn't good enough. My parents didn't love me enough, and nothing was enough, you know. And I didn't grow up in a poor area. I was very privileged. And so right from the start, there was something wrong. You know, there was something wrong. My dad was a self-made, achieved a lot in his life from starting with nothing. And so the expectations with us were pretty high. And I grew up in the 70s, and his drinking habits were pretty obvious from the time I was old enough to recognize that there was something different when he was drinking, you know, which was 90% of the time when he was home. And back then, alcohol was just socially acceptable everywhere and in cars. And, like, there was just no other... You just drank all the time, you know. So I was very uncomfortable and swore I would never be anything like him. I wouldn't drink like him, and I would never be like him, you know. And I certainly did achieve that. it's obvious, you know, when I had an older brother and an older sister, that I was picking up habits from them, and I didn't feel part of their age group, and I was just starting to behave to please them, you know, and I started to, I drank before I smoked my first joint, but they didn't fall, they came pretty close together. And, you know, for me it was a sense of arriving, just the way I felt when I arrived here. And I'll never forget that feeling. It was just, I didn't have to cope with my feelings anymore. I didn't have to cope with the fear, and I didn't have to feel not enough of anything anymore. I just wanted more, you know, and pretty much that's what I did for the next 25 years. So the career took off there at 12, you know, and the behavior started, the lying and the cheating and the stealing and, you know, alienating myself more from the family than before. And, you know, I have to say that I had a really good time for a long time. For a really long time, you know. And the drugs just got harder, and the drink wasn't enough, and then it was just more, and it just became out of control. I don't think my intention was to become an alcoholic, you know, and to end up in the church basement, but that's what happened. Like, it was just the path that happened to me, you know. And I don't think that any of the circumstances of my brother and my sister and my parents drinking and, you know, and my feelings are, you know, anything I can ever change. But I just feel today I understand that I'm a little bit wired differently. I have the disease of alcoholism. And that's where I put it, in that acceptance place, you know. It's something I've learned to accept. And I'll tell you a bit about how I got to my last drink, and I got to my last, you know, how bottom came real quick. It was a lot of fun for a long time, but the bottom was a slow, long bottom. I met my husband in the early 90s, and I started to do this drug called crack. And, you know, I think I drank to stop the feeling of the crack, you know, to fall asleep. So I never let go of the liquor totally. And but certainly that drug was what, that substance is what took over me, my soul. It kept me a prisoner for a long time. And for the next 10 years, that's what I did, you know. I drank to come off of that, and I ended up doing a lot of things that I was never brought up to do, you know, intensely. I went to any means to get what I wanted. And that brought me to some pretty nasty places. And jail was soon to become pretty well where I spent most of the 90s, you know. So I was married in 93 and had my son in 94. And, you know, it was just back and forth. I don't think I spent a first Christmas with my son until he was 5, until I was sober, because I was inside most of the time. If I wasn't inside, my husband was. And, you know, it was a pretty rocky relationship with two addicts and two alcoholics and a baby. And, you know, looking back on it now, it was a very codependent relationship, but he kept me pretty sane for most of the time, you know. That relationship kept me above ground for a while, you know. And we took care of each other, and when he passed away, and my son was 2, I think that's when the bottom started in 96. And the bottom was, for me, I was now on my own, and I had absolutely no support, so there was no way I could end up in jail. And what eventually did happen, my worst nightmare happened, was when Youth Protection took him away from me in 98. So, you know, he's 4 years old. We've moved around everywhere, but ended up always back in Montreal. We were in New York for a while, and we just came back to Montreal. Then we'd go to, I was drifting, you know. I have this this building that I own in ABG, but I was too scared to go there because there were warrants for my arrest. There was no furniture in there. I had sold washer, dryer, fridge, stove, everything. And I had this abandoned, beautiful home, you know, that I was afraid to go back to. And so, you know, it was so unmanageable. I was just a slave to this whole situation, and I was just spiraling and spiraling, and I had a child in my care. And when, you know, whenever I went to jail, for me that was the greatest relief. Strange to say, but I didn't have to run for anything, and I didn't have to run from anybody. And I didn't have the responsibility of taking care of my son. What Youth Protection did for me was smash my ego. When that day arrived that they took my son from me, that was like a real blow to my ego. And I think then, for the next 6 months, I'm coasting on figuring out how to stay above water and how to, you know, get him back and keep my life a crime and just continue on. I had no desire to get out of this disease. It was just out of control, and I just didn't think I deserved anything better, you know. And it was never enough. And I had some friends, and they helped me out. We got the best lawyers, but if I didn't stop using and drinking, I wasn't getting anywhere, and I was just spinning, you know. My son didn't want to see me even. He's 4. We're supervised visits every once a week. And he doesn't even know who I am after 3 months. Like, he's got such a good life with my sister. That I'm just going to go into a little quick detail there. She was very instrumental in me coming into the program. She was the one that called Youth Protection on me, and she claims to have had a spiritual moment, knew I was back in town, and knew where I was on a certain day. And that's how they found me and my son. And she had been in the program for 2 years. So she's still in the program today. So for about 4 years, she was the enemy, right? But it took me 4 years of recovery before I started to change, and I didn't change. I changed reluctantly. I did not want to change. But this program got to me. It did. So what happened was when they took my son, my ego was smashed. And I had to surrender, and I tried every which way to get him back, but it just wasn't happening. And my sister had nothing to do with me. She wouldn't allow me any type of special treatment. And for that, I'm grateful. And youth protection, judges, whatnot, would not give him back to me under any circumstances, even after I was close to a year sober. So the lesson was hard for me, I had managed to manipulate the criminal system most of my life. Now this is something I couldn't mess with. They just had my number and my time was up. And I believe it was a power greater than myself that did that. Because I was restored back to sanity when I came into these rooms. I'll never forget that last drunk, that last drug, and knowing that I had made a decision the next day not to use. And that's exactly how it happened, in 1998, August 31st. I just knew that the 1st of September I had to see my son. I had to supervise some psychological evaluation, and it was a very important day, so I didn't want to use and drink. So that's what I did. I remember taking the last drink and being stone cold sober. Sober, like that. I couldn't even explain how I was just not getting a buzz anymore. The crack wasn't doing it. Nothing was doing it. It's as if something was telling me, go to bed and tomorrow's another day. And I had never thought of that in my life. I had to pass out. That's the way I went to bed. I passed out. So, I knew there were meetings, and I had been through several treatment facilities during the course of my career. And I knew that there was a meeting in Montreal that I could go to. I also checked in at the checked out the Griffith House in Montreal to see if they had anything that they could help me with. I was special. When they told me I had a 6-week waiting list, I thought I'm never going to be able to stay sober for 6 weeks while I'm waiting for them. So I came to a meeting, And I must have lucked out, and I think another intervention from my higher power, because I was taken into the Griffith House and just like right under their wing in the next 3 weeks, and I had managed to not pick up, and I had managed to get to that appointment on September 1st, and every day was just like good, and I was at a meeting 3 times a day, and I started therapy, and all I needed was the willingness and thinking that I maybe can get out of this. There was hope. There was hope after one day of not drinking. There was hope. And then I was just welcomed into Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just like I belonged, I had some different types of sponsors. I really have a hard time with that word. That didn't really sit well with me. The first sponsor was probably one of the first speakers I heard, I was just so eager. I was like an eager beaver. I had to get it. And they told me to get a sponsor, so I got one. But that was authority, For me, that's the way I thought. So anybody, if you tell me what to do, I'm going to turn around and do the opposite. Or if, you tell me to call you, that might be good for me. I don't know what's good for me, but I'm just kind of testing the waters, and there's certain things I didn't like that were happening, and I still kept coming back, and then I met different people, and I felt welcomed all the time. Like I went to enough meetings to finally hear, enough things that applied to me and made sense. So if you don't hear something tonight that you can't relate to, there's other meetings, and don't give up on one. That's my point. And I just felt I had different fellowships. I was attending as many meetings as I could. And, you know, my son, I have to, the first or maybe second supervised visit that I had with him greeted me with open arms because I was clean and sober. He felt it, right? When I used to go to his visits, I used to look at my watch and I couldn't get out of there fast enough. He felt that, you know. So things started to change. His attitude had changed. The social workers were smiling at me. The receptionist knew who I was, and she wasn't, like, dreading the day I would come in and start screaming or something and demand my son, and why isn't he here? And, no, I was becoming a little bit more manageable and easier to talk to, you know. So, you know, I went through a lot with the social workers. I wasn't a piece of cake, and I had some warrants. I had to turn myself into prison and finish some time up. And another, you know, reason why I'm involved with the prisons now is I went in on a Thursday night, and I knew there was a French meeting, and that was one of the reasons. I had about 62 days of sobriety recovery, and I turned myself in, and that was, you know, something I really struggled to do. I didn't know what I was looking at. I was turning myself in, putting it in God's hands, because y'all told me that I should put things in God's hands. And so I did, and, you know, it was also very, the only solution, really. I had to clean this up. So it was a Thursday night, and there was a French meeting in prison, and I knew it. But the process of going to a meeting in prison can be difficult. They can really make your life difficult. And it's an application, and then you wait for a response. I couldn't wait 2 weeks. I came in with a big book, you know, and I came in sober, and I needed to go to a meeting. I had passed the day in court and in handcuffs, and it was insane. I was brought back to all my old ways, you know, and the guard or the program, I didn't know, but I said, if you don't let me go to a meeting, I don't know what I'm going to do. Again, I was threatening, you know, but that was not unusual for me. They knew me there. I was just one of their better customers, and he let me go to a meeting, and I'll never forget him because I still see him today, and he loves me to death, and I love him to death, and I swear he was so instrumental in letting me go to that meeting. He bypassed all kinds of rules, but he knew how serious I was. And I tried to 12-step every person I was there in my sector, of course, you know. And these girls, I mean, they just, you know, they're what, yeah, well, we'll see when you get out because we've heard this before, you know. I think there was a difference this time. When I got out, I knew I was going to be a miracle. This is for me. This is what I have to do. And I think my faith was very, kept me straight and sober in there. And I read the big book a couple of times back to back and preached the big book and did all the meetings I could get to inside. And I didn't end up doing the year that was left on my sentence. I'm not sure why I was blessed, but I had some people there to help me, and I was released after a month and sent home and put on probation, you know, and that's 1998. So I haven't had a drink since August 31st, 1998. And I think that the desire left me. I think the desire left me really quick. It was just my time, you know, and I say that to some of my sponsees when I ask them to do or suggest they do something. That's the way I was, and if you're doing it, it's just your time, you know. Your time has arrived. I always feel something when somebody's asking questions and they're willing to listen and they're just ready to do whatever they have to do because they're sick and tired of being sick and tired, and that's what I was. And that's what I work with my sponsees, you know. That's what they're there for, to remind me, and they keep me on the ball too, you know. I didn't, like I said, you know, I didn't change right away, and I didn't want to change right away. It had taken me 25 years to get there, and I didn't think it was going to take me 25 minutes to get back, and I didn't want it to take me 25 minutes. I was still very much in the blame, you know. I wasn't always mostly never in the solution. not until I started working the steps and joined a workshop that I was able to start having an open mind, you know. And it's a miracle that I have a child as healthy as I have today, considering the situation I was in when I was pregnant, considering how he was born. So finding a power greater than myself was really not a difficult thing to do. The reunion between my son and I was long. It took a long time for him to come back to me, into my custody. I think that was another way of God showing me that I had to get well before I deserved to be a parent. That he had given me a child so wonderful, and I had been given a second chance, you know. It gave me the opportunity to do a lot of meetings and to get well. And I was very resentful about that, you know, not getting him back so quick. But in hindsight, it was the best thing that could have happened to me. He's going to be 13 in a couple of weeks, and he's just a great kid, you know. The workshops, I think I got off track there, but the workshops that I was taught how to do my steps were probably what let me forgive myself and make amends to people and put my past where it belongs, in the past. And even yesterday is the past. Like, I make still a lot of mistakes, but I can put them in the past and I can leave them there and learn from them. And I like to think that I can live in the miracle of 10, 11, and 12, even when things don't go my way. That's even harder than making amends or realizing what I've done wrong in a day is actually a very honest way to look at myself, you know, at the end of the day. But being unable to control situations for me is my hardest. That's what I battle with, you know. Things don't go my way or fast enough. I still have a huge problem with that. Like, it's a big issue. And I know that I need to call my sponsor, let it go, stop controlling it, go to a meeting, you know, just all those tools that I've been taught in here, they work. But when I'm in my disease and I want to sabotage my life, I'm the expert at it. Like, I can just stay in it for more than a day, 2 days, 3 days, you know. And there's my 11th step. I can stay on the 10th and make sure I'm taking my inventory. But that 11th step really can, I can fight it like as if I'm fighting the drink. But I don't have a desire to drink. I just have a desire to have things my way. And it's a battle. Like, I know I need to meditate and I know I need to let it go, but I just don't seem to do it, you know. I'm fighting really hard with certain things, like to clean up some wreckage and to be pardoned. And I've been waiting a long time for my pardon, you know. And I've taken a chance, I've taken a risk, and I've gone back to school, and I won't be able to practice what I'm going to do if I don't have my pardon. And I'm just spinning, you know, and it's like, it's the injustice of the government and it's everything, and I'm just going, like, really getting myself into, you know, a pickle without drinking. So that's when I have my sponsor, and my sponsor's especially like, you don't sound like you're having a good day. Shit, no, I'm having a lousy day. But really nothing's changed except that it didn't go my way, you know. I didn't yet get my answer. Or I'm... might not get the answer I want, you know. And that too, I have to really accept, you know, acceptance of that happening is huge. It's a very huge possibility that I'm not pardoned for my acts, and I'm going to have to accept. It's not going to be the reason to drink, you know. So I'm getting an education now, and I'm persevering. You know, I know that it's what I want, and for the first time in my life, like, after making a decision to come into Alcoholics Anonymous, it's probably the most important thing I've ever done, you know. So there will be a door that will open. If that closes on me, there is a door going to open. And that's where I need to remember that that's never let me down. That is so true. You know, I've seen it for other people. And, you know. So working my 12 step, I love to go to area and district service meetings. I realize as much as I hate getting up on a Saturday morning and showing up and bitching about it all week, thinking I have to do this. Like, this is part of my commitment. And I want to quit this commitment, you know, because I'm doing this coordinator's position. It's got to be there. And I can fight it, but it's when I arrive, it's like, yeah, I like these people. They're so dedicated to this program. And all this structure that comes within it. I hate structure. I've hated structure all my life, and here I'm right smack in the middle of it, and I love it. So I don't really know what's good for me necessarily. Once I get there, I'm really happy to be there, and I really now met all these people in French and English, and everybody it's just harmony. It's just amazing how that works, you know, and how big we are. Anywhere in the world, I can go to an AA meeting, and I'll know what they're going to read, you know, and we're all reading the same solution. We're all living in the same solution. It's a miracle, you know, 200-300 alcoholics that are there on a Saturday morning at 8:30 in the morning saying the Serenity Prayer. It's pretty cool, you know, it's pretty cool. And we all have a common purpose. This works. So that's how my 12-step, how I feel about my 12-step these days, and carrying the message behind the walls in prisons, for me, is because I've been there, I guess. But even people that haven't been there always tell me, oh, I love this place. Like, this was great. This could have been me. I just didn't get caught, you know. When people say that to me and they have never done time and they've never been to prison, it's because they understand how the disease has brought them far. And they just didn't get caught. Like, that's just an eye-opener, like, for a lot of us, you know. We've all suffered. I've suffered terribly, but I don't have to live like that anymore. You know? So I feel grateful when I'm going there. I feel grateful that I can carry the message. There's still some girls that are saying to me, you're still reading that book? It's because I'll open up the big book at a meeting and, well, some girls are still doing time that I did time with. That's pretty scary. You know, when they're saying, you're still reading that book? Yeah, I said, there's a solution. There's a story about you, too. And, oh, no. There's a few books in their library. Go get it tomorrow. There's a story about you. No. Yeah, it's true. There's all kinds of things in that book. And so, you know, I leave them the book, I leave them the pamphlets, and I leave them my phone number when they get out. I know where to call, they have a meeting list, and that's the best I can do, you know. I've seen some people take their cake, come out and take their cake at meetings and call me. That's, you know, it's a miracle. This program works, and I've chosen to live in this program, and just, this is my family, this is my home. You people have taught me how to live and have made my life manageable. I want to thank you for my recovery.